Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Christopher Jones Cruz, Dan Friedel, and Anne Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will bring us the first part of a new VOA Learning English series called America's Presidents. But first, here is Christopher Jones Cruz.
Millions of single people turn to the Internet to meet other singles. Many use dating websites in hopes of finding that special someone. But there are some people who want nothing more than to trick singles, using their desire for a loving relationship to get their money. VOA recently investigated one such effort. Criminals used pictures of United States Armed Forces members to steal money from women around the world. One of those women is Lilo Schuster. She began looking online to try to find a boyfriend or a husband. Then one day, Schuster received a promising email from someone on a dating website. The message came from someone who claimed he was a pilot in Afghanistan. The relationship quickly became serious. Schuster said she fell in love. She soon began sending the man emails throughout the day. He sent her poetry and messages, saying he loved her. He even sent her pictures of himself in his military clothing. Schuster noticed that the man did not write well, but she remembered her father was an immigrant, and his writing was not very good. So she did not think it was a problem. But she and her love interest never spoke by telephone. When she asked to do so, the man said he was not permitted to do so. After a few weeks, the man told her he needed money to help his daughter go on a school trip. So she sent a few $1,000s to Britain, where the man said his mother lived with his daughter.
I'm helping him. This is for our future. It's embarrassing, but that's the feelings that I was feeling.
But after she sent the money, the man asked for more. He said he wanted to leave the Air Force and join some of his friends who were starting a small company. The man told Schuster that the Air Force would not let him remove money from his bank account. He said he needed her help. She was suspicious, but she still sent more money to him.
You're so scared you don't want to lose them. You'll just do anything. And that's what I did. So I just started to continue to wire money.
Schuster sent a total of $22,000. Almost immediately after she sent the last amount, he stopped sending her emails. Chris Gray is with the U.S. Army's Criminal Investigations Command. He says he has heard stories like Schuster's many times.
It's been just overwhelming. We are dealing with thousands of these. I've personally spoken to women who've given up upwards of $75,000, $80,000 to someone that they've never met in person.
Online criminals are also targeting people in other countries. Gray says women from Japan, Britain, and Australia have called his office. He says they thought they were in love with a U.S. service member, but were actually being tricked. Gray says many of these criminals operate from cyber cafes in West African countries like Nigeria and Ghana. He says they take photographs of U.S. troops from social media. They then create a story and begin to target women on dating sites. Gray says there are several signs to watch for. They include misspellings on documents and mistakes with capitalization. Schuster turned her anger into action. By sharing her story, she says she helped a woman in New Zealand and an American discover that they were being lied to. If you suspect you are being tricked by someone online, do not send them money, especially if they are in another country. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Most college students would love to get an assignment like the one Madeline Ota recently received at Stanford University. She and her classmates were asked to make beer in their dorm rooms. But before you get too excited, you need to know that it was for a class called The Archaeology of Food. And the assignment was to make beer according to a 5,000-year-old Chinese recipe.
I think it was a bit different than beers that you would buy in the store because it had only had a week to ferment. And I think that is one of the biggest differences that you would notice in taste, because after only a week, the alcoholic content isn't very strong.
Ota and her classmates made two kinds of ancient beer, some of which are still being made by indigenous people today. One of the beers was made by grinding grains like wheat, millet, or barley. The other was made using a root known as manioc or cassava in different parts of the world. The students chewed the root and then spit it into glass containers. Their saliva began the fermentation process. Water and heat were carefully added to each mixture. Ota said she has a new appreciation for what goes into making the beer people buy at stores or at the local bar.
This is not something that we should take for granted when we go and pick up something from the store. That doesn't just apply to beer, but kind of any sort of processed food. Like, there is a whole story behind how this got to where it is, how people produced it, how they cooked it.
Their professor, Li Liu, discovered the old Chinese recipe. Liu and a graduate student, Zha Zhengwang, reverse engineered their beer recipe based on substances found in clay pots from northeast China. That means they studied the residue and made guesses as to what the original ingredients might have been. The researchers found evidence of barley, an important grain in making beer today. Until Liu and Wang did their research, most historians thought barley arrived in China more recently.
Again, that's where experimental archaeology comes in, because when you have this small residue from an archaeological artifact, you know, you don't have the full story. You may have parts of a bigger story, but you don't know how those parts necessarily fit together. So experimental archaeology is really cool because it allows you to experiment with those processes and see which ones are the most successful.
Ota said, "We can learn a lot about ancient cultures by learning about their food and beer."
You know, when the first people started actually having farms and agricultural societies, very soon after that, they actually started making the first alcohols using various techniques having alcohol became a very culturally significant and religious experience for many communities, and it went on to become a really important part of their society.
Because the class treated the beer making like a science project, they were able to add their information to the scientific record. Every ingredient was carefully measured. Every degree of heat was noted. Thanks to the students, there is now a very specific record for how to make these ancient beers. In the past, the instructions might have been, "Fill the pot with water," Oda said. But no one ever knew how big the pot was or how much water was used. But the most important question is, how did the beer taste? The beer made from grain, Ota said, was fruity, like a cider. The one from manioc root smelled so bad, like cheese, she didn't want to try it. I'm Dan Friedel.
Looking at a rainforest from high in the sky, you might think all the trees look about the same, but they are not. Take, for example, the Amazon rainforest in South America. Research shows that the Amazon's biological diversity, the huge number of plants and animals living there, is more of a mix than experts believed. It turns out the rainforest has many species of trees and even different kinds of forests. The Amazon covers an area of about 7 million square kilometers. It lies within the borders of 9 countries: Brazil, Peru, Colombia, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Guyana, Suriname, and French Guiana, which belongs to France. About 60% of the rainforest falls within Brazil. For about 150 years, researchers have explored the Amazon. They searched under its tall trees to study the many plants growing there. Greg Asner has done that too. He is the principal investigator for the Carnegie Airborne Observatory program. Asner studied the plants and then, with his team, developed a tool to identify what is growing in the Amazon rainforest. They use an airplane equipped with a high-technology laboratory to create maps of the area. When the plane flew over Peru, the team learned there are many more and different kinds of forests than was documented before. Researchers once thought the western Amazon had 3 to 5 different forests. Then, Asner notes, his team mapped the area in the CAO aircraft.
We flew over and we mapped 36 distinct forest types. And so what we did was we just increased the diversity of the region by tenfold. And that's important because the region, the Peruvian Andes and Amazon, just like all the other countries that occupy that region, are rapidly developing.
The CAO is equipped with airborne laser-guided imaging spectroscopy. This technology enables Asner and his team to take three-dimensional images of the forest far below. These pictures give the appearance of length, width, and depth. They have bright colors and look like modern art paintings, yet they show different tree species. Asner says the team is gathering more than just pictures of plants.
And at the same time, we're able to assess the health, composition, and types of trees that are there from their chemical signatures.
He says getting chemical information on the trees is like a doctor taking blood from a patient. The images tell the researchers about the health of the forests and gives them genetic information, too. But how can you get chemical information from trees while flying above them? Asner says the CAO aircraft uses sunlight as the main measurement tool. The sunlight reflects off the tops of the trees. With the equipment on the plane, they can measure infrared light, the light that cannot be seen.
This is in the shortwave infrared, so we can't see this with the naked eye, but we're able to read the molecular composition of the tree canopy.
This information helps them understand how the plant species and forests change in different areas. Asner says they can use airborne laser-guided imaging spectroscopy over a huge area that has never been mapped. In this case, it is 76 million hectares in the Amazon. The Carnegie team joined with the Peruvian Ministry of Environment to study that country's forests. Asner says this technology is still new to science and it can help officials watch over and protect the forests.
The application to Peru is really a big step forward because it tells us that we can use this still new approach to map the composition of forests in this case and use that information to do better forest management, conservation, and planning for future changes that we know the region's undergoing.
He says their maps help researchers and government officials make decisions based on the actual biodiversity of each area. No longer are people treating the Amazon rainforest like a big green carpet, one that is the same everywhere. Researchers will be busy because they noticed plant species that are little known or completely unknown in the forest communities. The images will help Ecuadorian officials preserve their forests. The next step is to take the technology even higher, to orbit the Earth. Then, researchers may observe the biodiversity not just of the Amazon, but the whole planet. The orbiting satellite would remap the entire Earth every 30 days and measure the health of its biodiversity. Biodiversity is important to the health of the planet, Asner explains. It is the fabric that is under all the planet's systems, like water and food.
So where the different species are and what types of species we have actually affects all the major processes that regulate our climate.
So, Asner adds, finding ways to watch the Earth will help researchers make better decisions on how to save more species and help stop destruction of our planet. I'm Ann Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about George Washington. He was the first president of the United States. He served from 1789 to 1797. But he had many other accomplishments, too. He owned thousands of hectares of land in his home state of Virginia. He was a famous general who led the American colonists to freedom from British rule, and he presided over the convention that created the U.S. Constitution. For Washington, that was enough. He said he wanted to retire from public service and return home. But the country's new electors had other ideas. They wanted him to move to New York and invent the American presidency. Washington accepted the job as his duty. Washington was sworn in as president in 1789. At the time, a truly United States was still just an idea. Americans were unconnected groups. They came from different countries, had different religions, and spoke different languages. For example, a quarter of the people in the state of Pennsylvania spoke only German. Doug Bradburn is the founding director of the Washington Library at Mount Vernon. He says, when Washington took office, the country was fragile.
The chances that it would even survive were probably very, very slim.
Bradburn explains that Washington had to establish social and political unity. But the Constitution did not say how the president could do that. So, Bradburn says, Washington invented the job for all future presidents. He established a group of advisors called the Cabinet, as well as the nation's official money. He appointed a 6-member Supreme Court, and he created the Department of Foreign Affairs, now called the State Department. However, Washington said it was the president's responsibility to set foreign policy. Historian Doug Bradburn explains that Washington established the president not just as a figurehead, but as a decision maker. But he always used the Constitution as his guide.
He wasn't just trying to establish an office and then figure out a way to justify it. He was trying to work with his Constitution.
George Washington was born in 1732 in the colony of Virginia. His father died when George was 11 years old. As a boy, he learned reading, writing, and math. Then he worked as a land surveyor in western Virginia. Historian Joseph Ellis points out that Washington did not have a formal education. Instead of going to college, Ellis says, Washington went to war. He fought against the French and Indians as a British army officer. That experience informed Washington's worldview. Ellis describes the first president as a realist. At the same time, Washington was a very passionate man with extremely strong emotions. He was known to get angry, but he showed his temper to only a few people. Washington not only acted like a great leader, he looked like one. George Washington stood about 1.9 meters tall. That was a head taller than the average man of his time. He was very strong and very graceful. He was known as one of the best horseback riders and best dancers in Virginia. But he had a problem. Bad teeth. Unlike his wife, Martha, who was known for her lovely smile, George Washington began losing his teeth in his 20s. When he was sworn in as president, he had only one tooth left. Washington remains an important figure in the American imagination. Even today, people tell stories about him. One popular story, that he had wooden teeth, is not true. But he did wear dentures. They were made, in part, from hippopotamus ivory. And he did not chop down a cherry tree as a child, and then admit it by saying, "I cannot tell a lie." In fact, historian Joseph Ellis says, Washington lied many times. But it is true that as Washington became more famous, his reputation grew. People thought of him as a man who always did the right thing. Joseph Ellis says even Washington understood people would look at his writings and judge him.
Washington went from being a man to a monument. He was aware of the fact that he had a role to play and that all emerging nations need mythical heroes.
Washington became very protective of his personal thoughts. His wife burned most of their letters. Yet, we know a little bit about Washington's thoughts from other writing. One of his regrets, he said, was that he had not done something to end slavery. Like many plantation owners, Washington was a slaveholder. More than 300 enslaved people lived on his property. By the end of his life, Washington opposed slavery. He left a will ordering his survivors to free his slaves after his wife's death. Washington's will became relevant sooner than he might have liked. 3 years after he finished his second term as president, Washington fell ill. He had been outside riding his horse on a cold, wet day. When he came home, he complained of a sore throat. Over the next 2 days, his condition became worse. On December 14, 1799, he died in his bed, surrounded by his wife, enslaved maids, and friends. He was 67. Historian Joseph Ellis says one of the best things about George Washington was his ability to give up power. At the end of the Revolutionary War, General Washington surrendered his sword. And at the end of his administration, President Washington simply returned home.
You could trust Washington with power because he was so conspicuously willing to give it up.
Doug Bradburn says Washington was the right man at the right time. Bradburn, like many historians, calls George Washington the indispensable man. In other words, Washington was essential to the American experiment in self-government. He made ideas about American freedom real, and he showed that even the president would operate under the rule of law. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.